The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue, good morning.
Good morning to you, Pat.
Now, you have a smile on your face this morning because you're looking at the front page of the Irish Times and the poll numbers are improving.
Well, Pat, as a veteran of polls and a veteran indeed of seeing the political fortunes of governments change and go up and down, I never get too carried away with a very good poll nor too deflated by a bad one. All that being said, of course, I'm still human, and in the aftermath of a budget in which myself and Minister McGrath put such work into, it is good to see some recognition of that in the figures today.
All right. And it's a snapshot in time. Who knows where it will go, up or down. Now, looking at another situation on this island, and that is Stormont and what's to happen. I mean, it looks almost certain that a general election is going to be called up there, and it will probably happen before Christmas.
And we call on all who were involved in the negotiations, and in particular, of course, the DUP, to do all they can, even at this late moment, to avoid an election taking place in the run-up to a period in the year in which cost of living challenges will be very acute, and in which voters in the north, as they would here, expect progress on many, many matters. I'd make the case broadly, Pat, if you look at where we are with the election of a new Prime Minister in the United Kingdom, a new cabinet being formed. We now have the potential for political stability within the United Kingdom. Obviously, that is in place in Dublin, and these are prerequisites for trying to make progress with regard to the protocol. And what would be, I believe, a real missed opportunity is exactly the moment in which you have moments of stability taking place in Dublin, London and Brussels, to then see the instability that could be caused by an election that could be avoided occurring, making our difficulties in relation to the protocol all the harder.
And the prediction would be that the numbers might not be terribly different at the end of an election.
That looks to be the case, but given the challenge the protocol has posed, and given how important it is in terms of resolving so many of the issues that have flowed from Brexit, at exactly the moment in which this potential for at least engagement between London and Brussels, I just ask all those who were involved in this decision, and particularly the DUP, to reflect on what could happen if that window of opportunity goes.
Now, the Taoiseach said yesterday that we cannot go back to direct rule as it was done before. What did he mean?
So what he was referring to there is in the Good Friday Agreement, there's the potential for the Irish government to play a role through intergovernmental arrangement regarding the governance and arrangements that would take place in Northern Ireland. And what would happen if the devolved institutions, which is Stormont, what you're questioning me about, if that was, they were not to be resumed, we would then look for us to play our full role under the Good Friday Agreement in relation to matters pertaining to Northern Ireland.
In terms of a red rag to the DUP bull, that kind of thing, that, okay, if you don't have bring back the Stormont Assembly and the Executive, well, you have your direct rule, but the Republic of Ireland will be involved in your arrangements.
Well, in fairness, all the Taoiseach was making the point is in relation to an arrangement that is there in the Good Friday Agreement. But it goes back to the point that all members of the government, and in particular the Taoiseach, have stressed for so long, which is that an election displays the potential not to change the political environment too much within Northern Ireland. And at exactly the moment in which there is at least the prospect for engagement on the protocol, on trying to make progress on some of the issues that we've had to confront for so long, surely we should use the time ahead to do that.
Yeah, surely we should, but that is not necessarily how it'll play out. Now, there was a softening of approach, we were told, when Liz Truss was briefly in power. Rishi Sunak seems to be wedded to the protocol bill, though, does he not?
He has indeed voted for it, and he has made clear his support for that piece of legislation. Also, though, as a member of the government of Theresa May, he then voted for other arrangements with regard to Northern Ireland at different points in the Brexit process. And what we would hope for and we believe can happen is full and proper engagement take place with the new government in relation to issues that have developed with regard to the operation of the protocol. And I would hope that the new Prime Minister, as he looks at all of the different issues that he would need to manage, would be willing to engage fully and in good faith with the EU in these matters, and I believe he will.
Now, some of the quotations that we've actually ventilated on this programme from him saying, for example, that the slump in the economy in the United Kingdom as a result of Brexit was not unexpected, he said. Also, he is wary of the prospect of a trade war with the EU. Do you know the man? Have you come across him?
I know him well. I worked with him for the entire period across COVID, and I've met him on many, many occasions. And he is a man of, I believe, the highest standards, with a very deep commitment to public service. And he's an exceptionally capable politician. And while I will also, in line with acknowledging all of his many qualities, also acknowledge his commitment to the Brexit cause, and he is, he has said on many different occasions that until very recently, the hardest moment in his political career was deciding to be one of the early supporters of Brexit. And it's important to recognise that.
But doesn't it show a lack of both political and economic judgment to support a project which has turned out to be a disaster?
Well, the impact of the Brexit decision on the British economy is one for those involved in running the British economy to make a view on. We've always argued very strongly and made the case for Brexit not happening in the run up to the referendum. But we've equally always fully accepted the view of the British people while acknowledging now that many of the consequences that we expected to happen did happen. And I do believe that during the Brexit referendum, some that were involved in making the case for Brexit did not acknowledge the consequences, the trade-offs in relation to that, many of which with regards to the island of Ireland have now come to pass. But all that being said, the British people have made their decision. We fully accept the outcome of that referendum of many years ago now. And what we, but mainly through our colleagues in Brussels, want to see yet again happen is engagement to see if we can resolve these matters. And I believe our colleagues in the Commission are willing to play their part.
When you talk about, you know, the British economy and it's their job to fix it, because it is certainly broken at the moment, one of the ways to fix it would be to have a comprehensive trade deal with the EU, perhaps entering the single market again, deciding to adhere to the standards, all the nonsense that Boris Johnson was speaking when he was a journalist and then subsequently about straight bananas and all that kind of nonsense. Standards are about actually improving things, not about making life difficult necessarily. Do you think that Rishi Sunak could have an appetite for that kind of thing? Because entering the single market would solve the protocol problem instantly.
I think we are some way away from arrangements that would involve re-entry back into the single market, or which would be very indeed politically challenging for the European Union itself, or arrangements that take the United Kingdom very close, quickly, economically to the EU. All that being said, if I was just to look beyond where we are in the next few weeks and the next few months, I continue to believe that the United Kingdom and the European Union have far more in common than we do, that we differ on.
Now, we have a special relationship.
We do, but even recognising that special relationship, if you look at the change that's taking place across our world, whether it be climate change, whether it be the impact of non-democratic governments in leading very powerful countries across the world, I believe the United Kingdom, the European Union and Ireland are on the same side on those existential issues.
Sure.
And I believe there's an opportunity over a period longer than weeks and months for us all to come together again.
The question, I suppose, is, our relationship with the UK is very close. Great trading relationship, North-South, has been prospering under the rules, one way or the other. But I'm wondering how much GB skepticism there is in Europe. You know, when an international treaty is not observed, when, you know, behavior is not as you might have expected from a sovereign nation. I mean, are the Europeans kind of sick of the Brits?
There is a the need and a clear need for all sides to rebuild confidence in each other again. Is there fatigue in the European Union in relation to this? Not amongst those who were involved in the negotiation, there ain't. But it is the case that the consequences of Brexit are now only one of so many issues that the European Union is confronting.
So GB has slipped down the pecking order in terms of priorities in Europe.
So for those who were involved in doing the negotiation, for those in the Commission who are dealing with this, it is their number one priority. But it's obviously the case that as Europe is dealing with the consequences of a war, of the return of high levels of inflation due to energy, that those issues by some way are getting the lion's share of attention. But if I could just briefly just offer one image that I think sums up the opportunity that is still there. A number of months ago, I had the opportunity to visit my colleagues in Estonia as part of the work that I do within the European Union. And when I arrived there, there were three flags flying near the airport of Estonia. The national flag of Estonia, the flag of the European Union, and the flag of the United Kingdom. And the reason why that had happened is recently Prime Minister Johnson had visited Estonia. But more broadly than that, the UK is playing a very big role through NATO in that part of Europe. And it's just an example of the kind of cooperation that is still taking place, which does demonstrate to me that if we were able to make progress on the protocol, which we want, there is, I believe, opportunities for cooperation in the future that would be to the benefit of all.
You mentioned the war in Ukraine, and of course, the crisis there has had its effects here, the arrival of so many refugees. There was much made of the fact that something less than 50 Ukrainians could not find a bed and were temporarily on the floor or on a mattress or whatever in Dublin Airport. That facility to house 200 in Dublin Airport temporarily has been opened, so the short-term problem resolved. We're hearing about army barracks being used, maybe up to 500 beds could be found. There is a suspicion, though, that, you know, we're doing more than our share of the heavy lifting.
So if you would look at the figures that look at where Ireland stands in terms of number of people who arrived into our country as a share of our overall population, we're broadly in the middle. So we are taking in a lot of people into our country, and we are, but there's no evidence to say that we're at the top of the pack.
No, but we're adding, say, so far, maybe 1% to our population.
So if you look at the figures in relation to that, that is the case. So if you look at the number of people who arrived into our country due to the war in Ukraine, it's approximately 55,000 people, and they are fleeing a war. And we, I believe, are responding back to that in a way that is so appropriate and generous and does reflect the values that our country holds dear. I do believe it is important that when we are dealing with the consequences of the first war of scale to happen in Europe since World War II, that we respond back as well as we can to it, which we are doing.
I think there is a goodwill towards Ukrainians because people see the fix they're in. The
and
goodwill,
see the horrific situations that they're fleeing.
Sure, and horrific. No place to go back to, the houses destroyed.
Whatever challenges we face, and we face so many challenges, I think we are all aware that we are dealing with people who are still predominantly women and children who are coming to our country with worried that their homes are going to be blown up.
And there is an ambition.
Their son or their father could lose their life in a war.
There's an ambition also for people to earn their own living. Now, I know there is talk of tweaking the arrangements whereby if people do get a job, that they then contribute in some way to their accommodation, their meals and so on. Where do we stand with that at the moment?
So we are examining that. And the reason why we're examining this is if you look at the figures regarding participation in our economy, and participation in our schools and universities of Ukrainians who've come to our country very recently, they're very good. So out of the 55,000 people that have come to Ireland, roughly 10,000 of them are now in work, 15,000 of them are in our schools, and 5,000 are now in higher and further education, which is a remarkable tribute both to them and also to the work that we've all done together. And one of the things that we do want to look at, particularly given the desire that Ukrainian people have to work and to earn a living and to look after themselves, is what's the appropriate arrangements if they're then in a position of work. Yeah. We haven't made a decision on it yet, but it's something we do want to
discuss. Now, then there are the other people who are the, you know, international asylum seekers. And there is the impression that Ireland, in some cases, has been a soft touch. I mean, Georgia is not a country which you should be fleeing from. There's no war there. And yet people are seeking asylum here. Many people arrive at Dublin Airport having got on a plane with ID papers, because you can't get on without one, and emerge somehow into our system without any identification papers.
And we will fulfil and do fulfil our international obligations regarding those who come seeking asylum in our country. But we are not a soft touch.
We appear to have been.
Well,
we're now getting tight on the Georgians.
So I think what is happening, Pat, is because of the situation that is changing in Europe and across the world, in relation to the number of people that are now migrating, the number of people that are now moving, it is affecting the figures of the people who are seeking refuge in Ireland. I would acknowledge that. But all we are doing in relation to matters like those who are seeking either refuge or asylum here in Ireland is fulfilling obligations that we do have.
Yeah, but whatever happened to the Dublin Agreement, whereby, and it was signed off in Dublin, whereby wherever you landfall within the EU, that's where you stay?
And of what we will do is take all the steps that we can to make sure we deliver against that agreement while expecting others to do it. But what is happening is that, as all over Europe, we are seeing millions of people move due to the impact of a war. All of these systems are under strain, whether it's Ireland, yeah, whether it's Italy, whether it's other countries, because of the millions of people that are now fleeing a war and the impact that puts on our systems. Yeah. In total.
But the point being that if 1,000 people come here who don't have a right really to come here under any international convention, that's 1,000 less beds for Ukrainians.
And this is why we need to ensure that we are fulfilling our commitments, but that we're dealing with this whole issue now in a proper and a fair way. I believe we are. And of course, I anticipate and understand that at a time in which housing is already such a challenge for us, the government is expected to do all we can to provide new and alternative accommodation. And we are looking at all means possible to do this.
On housing, the concrete block and concrete products levy that was originally envisaged in the budget, did you blink?
Well, I did listen to the issues that people raised with me in relation to it. So I listened rather than blinked in relation to it.
You know what I mean? The CIF and other related building interests made a lot of noise about this. And they always make noise when they are in any way penalised. I mean, did you believe their entreaties?
Well, so if I did what many were calling on me to do, there wouldn't be a levy today. And there is one. The levy is at a lower rate, and it is happening later in the year than I originally planned. So I am not doing what so many have called on me to do. But I have, as you know, modified the plan. And what led to that modification happening actually wasn't the normal calls that are placed on me in public all of the time in relation to everything I do. I actually met many companies who were involved in the sector because they asked to meet me, and I do my best to fulfill such requests. And two things became apparent to me. The first one is that we have a large export business that employs hundreds of people here in Ireland, where we export what are referred to precast concrete items, which are concrete that's already formed, mm-hmm, a stairwell, something that's used in building a warehouse. And the point was made to me that if I went ahead with my original plan, those jobs could be lost. That was a fair point. For me not to respond back to that could have led to jobs being lost.
But when developers are talking about it's going to add 4,000 to the price of a house, the information came from the surveyors that's 1,200 to the price under the new form of the levy to the price of a typical house, 400 to the price of an apartment, or 600, whatever. Trifling sums in the context of the overall price of an apartment to a buyer or a borrower. So they have always managed somehow to squeeze the good out of everything.
But I'd respectfully make the point with regard to this that the voices that you're referring to called on the levy to go. They didn't want it. The levy is happening. And I did reduce the rate from 10% to 5%. which further reduces any potential knock-on cost effect to something that I believe is appropriate, given the fact that we're spending 2.7 billion euro.
But it might be trifling in the context of all the other increases in the prices of timber, the price of windows, all of the things that go into a house. And, you know, the developers target the state's element of it, which might be a tiny element in the overall increase.
Which is why I decided we still needed to have a levy, and that levy needs to go ahead in 2023. When you do every single budget, there are always issues that develop for scrutiny and political debate. And what I believe and would make the case for having done with where we are with that measure now is what I have modified the measure, which I fully accept. The levy is still happening. It's still happening next year. And 30 to 35 million euro is still a lot of money.
I'm sure they were still cracking open the Prosecco at the CIF.
Well,
anyway, we'd park that one.
Based on the case they're still making, I'm not sure that would be the case.
Now, Lisa Hone, the chairperson of the MICA Action Group, told the Oireachtas Committee that the proposed concrete levy is just adding insult to injury, and they called on, you know, chasing down the suppliers of the defective materials instead of doing what you're doing. There's no money there, though, to be got, is there, really?
This is the point. I mean, if there was the possibility for large amounts of money to be gained in compensation from those who were involved in this issue many years ago, that would clearly already be happening. But the challenge that
but are
is
you
there,
chasing anybody? Are you, you know, because if you supply defective materials, endangering life and limb.
Completely. This matter has been pursued by the Department of Housing. All avenues that can be pursued in relation to this are being pursued. But the reality is, we're about to start spending this money in a number of years' time, and whatever opportunity that we have for recompense in relation to it to the state won't be equal to the 2.7 billion euro that we're about to spend. And whatever the trade-offs are in relation to the levy, I believe the broader and more dangerous place to be is thinking as a state that we can spend billions of euro, but we never need to find a way of contributing to that cost. And that's why I believe the levy going ahead in the way that it
is. Yeah, but the taxpayer picks up the rest of the tab. That's the truth of it, which is the bulk of the whatever 6 point, whatever billion it turns out to be. For homeowners who already have a home, mortgages, and the variable rates are going to go up because of the ECB's actions in the past and their proposed actions. What do you say to those people who might be squeezed a bit? Have they been protected by the rules of the central bank, which have now changed?
So I believe while the focus of the macroprudential rules of the central bank are about financial stability rather than protecting individual borrowers, I do believe that because of the implementation of those rules over many years, it has constrained the level of borrowing within our economy and the level of private debt, which is going to be really, really, really important at a time interest rates begin to go up. But on an individual level, while acknowledging the overall macro story and overall story for our economy, of course, I do accept that therefore, if you're somebody who is on a variable rate mortgage, changes that are happening in interest rates, I accept are going to have an effect, and I do acknowledge that. The three things, though, I would really quickly say is, number one, over the recent period, over 80% of the new mortgages that are being issued are fixed rate mortgages, which does offer a degree of insulation for the future. Number two, there are still switching opportunities available from banks to allow mortgage holders to get better value. And then number three, I, nor indeed any government, cannot bring in measures that can compensate for what's going to happen to changes in interest rates. And indeed, if we were to do so, it would be counterproductive and potentially a new threat. Yeah.
But Finance Ireland
is bringing in other measures to help with the cost of living.
Finance Ireland is a non-bank lender suspending its fixed lending for the moment. Do you think that's a disease that's likely to spread, that fixed won't be available to borrowers?
I do believe that fixed rate mortgages are going to be available in the future. But at a moment of significant change in interest rates, I think you're going to see some lenders just pause to see how the market is going to change.
Now, with the spread that's available because of the higher interest rates, I mean, we were on negative interest rates until relatively recently. The banks can make a killing on the spread that there will now be between what they buy money and what they can sell it at. Did you sell your Bank of Ireland shares too soon?
Well, we still have a majority share in Allied Irish Bank.
I know, but your Bank of Ireland, you just disposed of the last of it.
So with Bank of Ireland, we now do not have any shares within Bank of Ireland. But part of the ingredient in the price that we got in the shares that were sold was an expectation that interest rates were going to change over time. And whenever you make any financial decision in relation to selling shares in particular, particularly if you're doing it on behalf of the taxpayer, there's always going to be those who will argue, I should have waited and shouldn't have done anything at all. But for AIB, we're still a majority shareholder and ample opportunity
ahead.
But
you might have lost a bit of a payday in Bank of Ireland.
Well, actually, if you look at where we are in Bank of Ireland, all the money the taxpayer put into Bank of Ireland, we got back.
Okay. You may not be in this job much longer because of the change of regime at the top of government. Taoiseach will become Taoiseach and vice versa, we think. What about yourself and Michael McGrath? Have you had, chats about the changeover?
I couldn't have a better working relationship and better personal relationship with a colleague in another party than I do with Michael McGrath. We've chatted about lots. We meet regularly. But
would it be seamless if you were to swap?
Oh, look, both of us accept that decisions in relation to who does what are decisions that will be made by other people in the party leaders. And it's really not appropriate that we comment on what they may do.
You cannot presume, at least in public.
I cannot presume in public, and I don't even presume in private, Pat. Mm. But I am absolutely confident that if I have the opportunity to continue to serve in cabinet with Michael, the relationship that we've had and the working relationship that we've had now over many years will continue.
Now, when you equivocated a bit about the big job and the European Stability Mechanism, which will be vacated by Kraus Regling fairly shortly, and then you very quickly came out to rule yourself out of the job. Is that still the case? Because you could be pressured by your European colleagues. You did such a great job that we need you.
I'm happy just to make very, very clear that my focus is on hopefully continuing to play a role in Irish politics, which I'm very privileged to do, which I love doing. And if you just look at the interview that you and I have done, Pat, and all of the different topics we've raised, the common theme that they all have is how much more we need to do and how much more progress we want to make, while me making the case for what we've also achieved. And I want to play any role I can in that here in my country, here in my home and in our country.
Pascal Donoghue, thank you very much. I don't know the next time, I don't know what cap you'll be wearing when you come into us, but you're always very good to drop into this studio. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.
For joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.